I may have sent you an email.
I think so, yeah.
You did.
I did.
Carol Noodle or something?
And by now, I'm on everybody's spam list because I'm sending too many emails. Yeah, we're here. So we're going to do syllabus introduction, so far in a second, lest I forget, so right off the bat, next week, Wednesday, 7 to 9 p.m., USC Spartanburg, upstate Spartanburg, is hosting these folks. Fanala, Kawali Group, Kawali, anybody recognize the word? Sufi Islam, anybody recognize Sufism? Okay, so Sufism, mystical tendencies, tradition in Islam, probably the most prevalent form of Islam, but it very recently. Most Muslims for most of history were actually Sufi. And this is one expression of Sufi Islam, Qawwali music, praise music, think gospel in Christianity, something along those lines, right? You probably will recognize that most of these folks are not from India / Pakistan, but are actually from the West Coast. So these are actually either converts or students of Qawwali musicians. Qawwali is usually found in the Indian subcontinent. But they are apparently very good, have masters that are well recognized, and they themselves performed in Pakistan already. USC Upstate organized this, and we are on board with that. Family is contributing a little bit of money. And I would encourage all of you to go. It's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime, you know, stuff like that happens every 10 years in the upstate of South Carolina, right? So you may want to take advantage of that. If you do want to take advantage of that, you know that you all have been around long enough that Furman lawyers always get nervous when Furman students go off campus. And so Furman lawyers have decided that if we invite you to any event off campus, we have to make you sign a form. You all seen these forms. How many of you have signed those before? So I pre-ordered tickets for everyone. So it's next week, Wednesday, from 7 to 9, and 2 to 3 questions. So question one is, who wants to go? And then the next question is, do you have transportation, or do you have buddies, friends, can you borrow a car, etc., etc., to get you there? Because I do not have that much space in my car, and I'm inviting something like 50 students. My car fits 5, actually only 4. One side you're not supposed to be sitting because of rust issues. Don't ask. So, question one. Who is interested in going? Okay, so, most of us. Whoever is interested in going, grab one of these forms, fill them out. Let's see, I tried to save paper in my earlier classes, so I actually printed 4 to a sheet, but then I forgot to hit the right button, so I have actually, for you not-so-young kids, the big print. So grab one. If you are going, please fill it out, return it to me, and by that I know that I'm supposed to be reserving a ticket for you.
You fill both sides?
Just one side, okay. Yeah. If you should decide between now and next week that you cannot go, do not want to go, or something like that, do let me know so we can return the ticket for somebody else. Okay? And then if you have transportation issues, at this point in time, anybody who wants to go, aware of transportation issues they may have. Anybody who would like to go and may want transportation. Anybody in here who could offer transportation to... Okay, so you talk amongst yourselves and kind of figure this out. If you can't figure it out, you know, last option is always type in rusty car if this is please. So yeah, just fill that out. And did you get 4? If you're interested, I don't want to. You're okay. All right. While you fill that out, let me pull out syllabi. if you have the forms ready, just send them over. If the fine print is too fine for you, there is an online version on Moodle. You can print your own copy. Most of you know by now that I like to save paper when I can. Assume that most folks met most folks, but I also assume that not everybody has met everybody in this class. So why don't we go ahead and go around the table, introduce ourselves, what we're doing in this class, prior exposure to Islamic studies, Muhammad Quran, what have you.
I actually didn't find the syllabus on
Google. You looked before I put it up. He didn't look the last 10 minutes.
Oh. Yes.
So, by now, yeah. Because I was working on it up until the very last second, and I'm sure there's still lots of mistakes in it. Sorry. forms over here. Why don't we go around the table, introduce ourselves, what we're doing at Furman, a little bit about background, what have you.
So you're good?
Sure.
Hey everybody, my name is Alex Kramer, I'm a sophomore at Furman University, and I'm actually a business and Spanish double major. And my inclination to take this class is actually due to one of my best friends, who's from Saudi Arabia, his name's Abdul, and he talked to me about a lot of the misinterpretations that most Americans have of the Middle East and Islam in general. And I talked to him a lot about life of Muhammad and a bit about the Quran. And I don't think he had the expert opinion or perspective, but I definitely wanted to get a lot more insight on those subjects. So that's why I'm here. Good. Nice to meet you all.
I'm Mark Frederick. I'm a senior history major with a minor in Middle East and Islamic studies. That's one of the reasons why I'm in this class. But I've taken a few classes in the past that dealt with Islam and on this subject, and I've always wanted to learn more.
Hey y'all, my name's Alex. I'm from Cocoa Beach, Florida. I'm a junior religion major with pre-med as well, and thinking about the minor of Islamic studies. And I'm also Dr. Typen's intro to Islam. Of course, I'm trying to get all of the Islam I can in one semester. I really try to learn as much as I can quick. So that's my goal. I'm really interested in it. So.
I'm Rebecca Edmonds. I'm from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I am a senior religion major. I took women, gender, and Islam last semester and just kind of wanted to learn more about it.
I'm Hunter Williams. I'm a junior sociology and Spanish double with the minor. And I've taken all the classes necessary, and this is the last one for the minor.
Hi, everyone. I'm Bethlehem Benacho, and I'm a senior political science French double major, and I'm also minoring in Middle East and Islamic studies and Islamic studies.
I'm Samuel Akhtami. I'm a senior biology major, also pre-med with the minor, and from Hickory, North Carolina, I think I said that. And so the reason I took those classes, my family has a lot of debates. We're from Syria, and so we spark a lot of debates about religion and the different reasons or the causes of the conflict in Syria. So having a better understanding of Islam as a whole would be pretty nice, and Muhammad, and especially maybe can delve more into the readings we did last year. And that women, gender, and Islam class, that was really interesting. So, also, I want to meet my sister in a debate, so I feel like this is really helpful.
I'm Liza Vega. I'm a senior history and education major, so I'm certified to teach social studies to high schoolers. Wish me luck. But I am interested in taking this class because I took Intro to Islam last year, and I've been interested in religious studies like throughout my time at Furman. I've been involved in interfaith work for the last like 6 or 7 years now, ever since high school, and continue to like go to conferences and just really interested in Islam as a part of that, and knowing more is the best way to try and understand how we all interact with one another. So, yeah, that's basically what I'm doing.
I'm Caroline. I'm a senior political science and Islamic studies minor, political science major. And I'm taking this course because I finished my minor, I finished my major, I just need something to take, and thought it would be cool.
One way of putting it, I'm going to be cool. We're going to see at the end of the term you tell me whether it was cool or not.
I'm Gabe. I'm a sophomore religion major, and I've got the minor, like I think everyone here.
Almost everybody.
Almost everybody.
We still have to convert a few. We'll send the missionaries later.
And I just think Islam is cool. I really do like religion as well as a lot of relies, excuse me, with the pluralistic aspect of it. Cool shirt, by the way.
Yours is in the box.
Yeah. But no, I also like it because it's the youngest of the Abrahamic faiths, and I took your class last semester. And the coolest part was sort of the Muhammad part and the Quran part, which we kind of just like sort of glazed over, and we'll kind of go for a deeper meaning on that.
So it's the youngest and the oldest, right? I mean, we all know, or someone
yeah.
Both arguments, right? Mm-hmm. So we are pre-Abrahamic, or Muslims make the argument Islam is the oldest, is the original religion of humankind, but also the youngest. So we got it all. Fantastic. So I think, yeah, most of you have taken classes with me beforehand, just a couple of cautions for those that haven't, two or three things. One, I'm really bad with names, even in small groups. I'm a historian, I know the names of dead people. Actually I will send around, most people know this already, right? The camera!
I love the camera.
That's the greatest.
Remember class taking pictures there.
And it actually comes in handy, not just for me to learn names, but also for...
megapixels.
Yes.
That's a new one.
It's ancient. Actually,
But it's different than the other one.
It is because... Let's see, that's just okay that... Because I had lost the charger of my new camera, and I was looking last night all over the place. I just found it in my office, so it's charging right now. So if these pictures turn out to be duds, I would send next week the newer camera. I forgot to bring my writing block. Does somebody have a sheet of paper that I can send around with it? Well, actually, we don't need the sheet of paper. I know you all. Just take a picture, either a selfie. This one, actually, let me show you.
It's like a handprint.
Oops, let's see. You can actually take a selfie with this.
The original selfie.
The only thing you need to be aware of is in the last section, a number of people were confused about the buttons. The picture button is this silver one down here without the red dot. If you take one with the red button, that's a video. So I have a number of video clips.
Yeah. Someone smiling for a moment. Just like a video of someone just like staring.
Right. For a second or so and then it goes off, right? So which are very hard to put on web and print out. And actually, the batteries may be dead on this one as well. We'll see. I try either selfie or take it from a person sitting right next to you. If it still works, otherwise we're going to next week with the real camera. Is it already off again?
Yes, off again.
Oh, then it's the batteries. Forget about it. We're going to do this next week with the real camera. Unless somebody has a camera or something on them.
I have a phone.
You have a phone?
Yeah, I forgot mine at home.
Can you email 10 pictures with your phone to me?
Sure.
I can.
Yeah.
Or what, if we all take a picture and then email it to you, would that be?
That's probably
probably be a little tricky.
Well, if everybody takes the individual pictures, I have different formats and so forth. It's kind of hard to do it. So if we have the same camera, same resolution, you want to?
Sure, why not? My phone's off, though.
Otherwise, let's wait until next week. I'm going to send one.
Wait, next week. Okay.
Yeah, that. And that way you can prepare yourself and dress the way you want to feel on the picture. This is just for me to actually... Your names shouldn't be a problem, knock on wood. But for future years, when 10 years from now you're coming back to homecoming or something like that, I have a page where I can quickly look and hopefully recognize you still 10 years from now. That's what it's about. We all good? Okay. So I sent out the syllabi. So what we're going to do today, I did not, I know some folks do this and send out reading assignments for the first day. In the future, I may do something like that. I didn't do that. So what we have on the menu for today is just looking at the syllabus, divvying up a couple of jobs, the responsibilities in class for the next couple of weeks, and then doing a little bit of brainstorming and basically just understanding the syllabus. And then I brought in a video, so toward the end of today's section we can, through video, kind of alert ourselves to some issues that are going to be raised in class. So that's today is going to be relaxed, easy schmeasy. Okay, so let's quickly have a look at the syllabus. Of course, description straightforward. You already know from the catalog. Three to four books, I should say. The three that we will work with, and most of them read from front to end. We're going to start out with Martin Lings's Muhammad, His Life Based on Earliest Sources. This is a somewhat problematic book in that it collates various early accounts of Muhammad together into one narrative. How many of you have taken courses on New Testament, Gospels, that kind of thing? Some of you have. How many of you are aware of the synoptic problem? Who has heard the term synoptics or synoptic problem? So what Lings is doing, more or less, synoptics refers to the early Gospels, the first three or four Gospels that are very similar but not identical in the way they narrate the life. And very similar, what Lings is doing then, he is taking the synoptic, you may say, Muhammad accounts and tossing them into one narrative. And biblical scholars know that that's a no-no, because you're kind of ironing out differences that may tell you important things about Muhammad. Right? So in that sense, it's not an ideal choice. The alternative to that would have been to actually read the original biographies, and the shortest one, or the one that is accessible, would be somewhere in the 700 to 800 pages. I didn't want to inflict that on you. That's why we ordered this one. Okay. So this is what we're going to tackle the next 2 weeks. We're going to read through it very quickly, familiarize ourselves with the traditional account, and make a couple of observations. When we read all of these, we're going to wear two hats, or more than that. And that is, we're going to wear the traditional conservative theological hat, i.e. how traditionally Muslims have understood a particular narrative or constructed a particular narrative. And since we're in academia, we're also going to wear the critical historical hat. So we're going to look at it in quote-unquote Orientalist fashion, with critical eyes, and look at how much of what we are reading here is actually historically accurate depictions, how much of it is maybe made up or something in between. Right? So we're going to be shifting back and forth between those perspectives. So just everybody knows this. Most of you have taken religion courses at Furman before. You know that religion courses are never Sunday school classes, right? We are looking at religion with a critical eye from a critical perspective, right? That's just our job. The one dogma that rules academic pursuit is whatever you get your hands on, you dissect as critically as possible. That's just what we do. Okay. All right, so that's number one. Number two, Fred Donner. also still on the life of Muhammad, but also a little bit on the Quran. And Fred Donner is kind of, whereas this is a traditional perspective, Fred Donner is one of many critical historical perspectives. He's kind of looking at the traditional accounts and then is looking also at his Doric critical stuff. Came out a couple of years ago, not highly controversial, I'd say, by now. It's kind of mainstream, but that kind of gives you more access to the historical critical aspect. And from there, then on to the Quran. Of course, the Quran itself, we're going to read quite extensively. I have, as recommended, the Pictorial translation that should be in the bookstore. But I leave it up to you to come up with your own translation. I know that there's plenty of stuff on the internet. There's apps for the various devices, Android and iOS. Whatever language and translation you're comfortable with is fine with me. I would say the more the merrier when we get to the Quran to see how different folks translated Arabic. It's going to be an interesting exercise. So I leave that entirely up to you what you want to do on that. Some of you may already have copies on somewhere around. Use those. Bring in whatever you want, as long as you have access to the Quran. Okay. And then that goes together with Carl Ernst's book that came out a couple of years ago. And this is actually a huge blessing. It makes available much of the critical scholarship, but critical scholarship with a very sensitive hand. And it makes available to us not just scholarship from this side of the Atlantic, but more importantly, from my biased perspective, scholarship from the other side of the Atlantic, German scholarship in particular. Those of you in biblical studies know this. The Germans just do a lot with ancient Christian texts and Jewish texts. The Germans also do a lot with ancient Muslim texts. So, you know, that's where much of the stuff is happening. And Carl Ernst did us a favor of translating and making available much of that into English. So those are the books. The way it's going to work is very different, or rather different from what some of you are used to me doing in the intro course. There's not going to be a whole lot of me talking except for today. We're going to read a whole lot of stuff per week. Some weeks actually entire books, and then we're going to go at it for 2.5 hours and see how we dissect that information, our observations on it, and so forth. And then roughly speaking, course divvied up 50-50, first half, familiarizing ourselves with scholarly voices and narratives, and the second half of the class is totally student-driven, you all pursuing your own individual research projects. We all will help each other out on that one, and then the latter part of the class, presentation of your materials. So, you know, we will read papers together that you are writing. We will help each other out with earlier drafts, etc. So it's really seminar style. This project is very much, in the end, very much student-driven. Right? So initially we help each other out to kind of familiarize ourselves with the field of research at large, and then it's up to you all to come up with fascinating topics and then fascinating research projects that we will share. So meeting once a week, 2:30 to 5:00. I am unionized, so I plan a break in between. So
Hallelujah.
Even though we're in South Carolina, we're right to work state. The last page is kind of a layout of reading assignments as are, and in all likelihood, some of them will change rather quickly. I'm still thinking about, you know, how to do this, and some of it depends on what you all are interested in. But that's, for the time being, the guide. What I will try to do is I will keep a running tab and updated tentative schedule on Moodle, so whenever we change reading assignments, I'm going to announce them either in class or through email. And in addition to that, I'm going to update the tentative schedule on Moodle so everybody is on the same page. And what I'm going to do is cut and paste this one onto Moodle, and then changes will be indicated in red. Whenever you see red, there's something new or changing appearing. Okay? in order to develop topics, those of you who've had me in the past know this, I would urge and encourage you develop topics ASAP. Start thinking about them actually already last week, ideally, but you know, very quickly. And then I have a staggered decision-making process. So a preliminary topic by September 11th, and then we're going to have some online discussions on Moodle. There's going to be discussion boards where you throw out your topic. Other students will react to that, so you're going to get some feedback on that one, and then gradually, in stages, develop those topics, right? So when you look at the syllabus, decision-making process starts Friday, September 11th, and then by noon, everybody will have posted their topic, and then students will leave comments and or suggestions on other topics by Monday, September the 14th. We're going to take all of the material that subsequent Wednesday, talk about it, kind of help you get in the right direction. Then the next step is the abstract stage, Wednesday 23rd. I want to see abstracts. And then we're going to start scheduling a presentation. So we're going to have a peer review stage in there. And so various deadlines for that one are outlined. Right? So the overview of the deadlines you see on page 2. Academic dishonesty, don't think I have to say a lot about that. Most of you have had me in the past, so you know that I take that very seriously. If students are interested, I have these worksheets where we can work together on, you know, what is proper citation, what is not. Do ask me questions on any of that, but I think most of you have done this in your writing seminar or whatever. So brief reference to the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. So if you qualify for that, make sure that you get documentation. I may already have gotten documentation from some of you. I got a lot of emails the last couple of days. So if you qualify under ADA and have accommodations, just make sure that you schedule the midterm exam. If you have extended time, schedule the midterm exam with the office, and that's mid-October. So that's on the tentative schedule. And then religion majors are aware of the religion major academic journal. Make sure that you do that. And that's that. And then we come to grading. So attendance, participation, 15%, right? Discussion leaders, we're going to talk about it in a second. 5%, midterm exam, 15. Let's see, did I do the math? That's 30, 40. Yeah, that works. And then presentations and responses. Same mistake I made, I think, last year. Did I make that mistake in the seminars? That we have two midterms. We have a midterm once at 15% and once at 20%. That's not good. forget about the 15%, and what I'm going to do, so just strike the first list of midterm. Thought I had caught this. I'm scatterbrained, most of you know that. So what I'm going to do is we strike that out, so we are left with 85%, and we're going to do the 85% over 100, invert that to get you to 100 points. You're all following the math on that. We're not going to give 15%, so the maximum grade that you could theoretically get would be an 85. That wouldn't be nice. Right? So what we have, I'm dividing the 85 by 85 and multiply the whole thing by 100.
I'm just going to trust you.
What is it, Eisenhower, who said, trust but verify? Yes, we're going to take care of the math and make sure that it's all right. Okay. So that's it in a nutshell. Questions on that? Everybody on board? Everybody knows what we're expecting of them? Good. Then the other technical thing that we need to do is, if you go to the tentative schedule, so we have these discussion leaders. So what I would hope and expect from discussion leaders is, of course, I expect everybody to participate in discussions every single time. But the discussion leaders in particular will take the job that I'm being paid to do. I'm just going to sit back and make you do it. And that is prepare questions on the readings that you have and start the discussion, right? So that would mean probably a brief summary of the materials that one read and then raise a couple of questions so that we get some interesting discussion, get, you know, what the meat of a particular reading is all about. You all following? Yeah. And so today I'm the discussion leader, but then the next, we have 10 folks in the seminar. So what I'm suggesting is that we just fill up the first 5 slots up until including September 23, 2 per slot. And then those 2 would get together after they've done the reading and divvy it up among themselves and then lead the discussion. So that having been said, who would like to do when and what? So you have kind of a rough, and of course that may change, right? You have a rough tentative schedule here. So we can start with traditional accounts, Life of Muhammad next week, and then, let's see, 1, 2, 3. Oh, it's actually including the 30th. I'm mistaken here, right? Because the USC Upstate event is, of course, not to be discussed. We're just going, right?
It also includes the 7th.
Does it? Mm-hmm. So we have the 2nd and the 9th, 16th, 23rd.
There's 6.
Right. So there's 6 topics altogether. But since we're only 10 people, I'm figuring that we first deal with the next 5 events, and then the last one we leave up to. At that point in time, we're all warmed up, and we don't need leadership anymore. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Because otherwise what we would end up with, we would end up with a couple of them being single and others double, and that would be unfair. Okay. So, so your choices are those dates all the way up and including September 30th. Who would like to do what when?
I can do
it. I want
23rd. Let's see. Anybody else on the 23rd who would like to do the 23rd? I just want to make sure that if there's more, then... Okay, got you down for the 23rd, Caroline?
I can do the 2nd.
Okay, 2nd.
Alex.
Yes, Alex. Okay, okay. Others?
Let's go for the
9th. 9th? Okay.
Let's do that.
Gabe.
I was going to jump on the 2nd.
On the 2nd?
Yeah.
Okay. Gabe.
I do the 9th as well.
The 9th? Okay.
I'll do the 16th.
Okay. Name one more time so that I can learn.
Mark.
Mark. Yes. We have a few slots left.
On the 23rd.
23rd, Isa. Okay. Very good.
16.
Bethlehem. And that will solve it for the 30th. The 2 remaining folks are Hunter and who else?
Me.
Yeah, Alex.
And Alex, what's your last name?
For Alexander, you can put Alexander, that works.
We have 2 Alexes, but you're Alex A, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Just to make sure that we have Alex A and Alex K differentiated from each other. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Sweet. Okay. You all know what you're supposed to be doing. So first round in particular, Alex K and Gabe, you're on board. You can figure it out. If you have questions, just drop me an email. Or we can meet before I do something like that. Great. Okay. That's the syllabus.
Okay, let's put that aside. And let's start looking a little bit at subject matter. So what we have in front of us, and what I intend to do probably for the next hour or so, we'll see how long we can play with this, is the topics at hand. Let's see. We, for the time being, don't need this one any longer. Let me just shut it down. So we have space on the board. So the title of the course, Muhammad and the Quran, right? Two big topics, and probably 10 or 15 years from now, this will be two different courses. There will be a course on Muhammad, and there will be a course on the Quran. I don't know whether I'm ever going to be able to pull that off, who knows. And of course, they are interrelated topics. Nobody in this class is coming to those two topics as a blank slate. We all already have had somewhat of an exposure to one or the other. Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to have to decide what we would like to work on. And one first question that you can ask yourself is one or the other. Would you like to work on something that is more related to Muhammad and his life? Or would you like to work more on the scriptural aspect, studying aspects of the Quran? You may answer, well, I want to do both. And that is not impossible. We can do that. But this is one way to taxonomize a little bit, right? So that's a question you can ask yourself. And then as far as a blank slate is concerned, none of us is a blank slate. We all know something already. And you can approach that know and that knowledge from a variety of perspectives. That is to say, there is one question that concerns this room, and that is how much of exposure to scholarship in Islamic, Quranic, Mohammedan study have you as an individual had, right? So there's, obviously we are not in a PhD program, we're not in graduate school, we have had some exposure to the field, but there's a whole lot more that we can read up on and learn, right? So that's one aspect, that's kind of the local question of how much we know. But then there's also the broader universal question of knowing, and that is the question as far as the field itself is concerned, how much knowledge is out there, and the question of how reliable is that knowledge, how contested is particular knowledge, right? And that gets us into this kind of neighborhood between traditional historical approaches and then a lot of revisionist approaches. So for example, and I'm not sure that I've done much of this in the intro class, we think we know that there was a person whose name was Muhammad who lived in the 7th century in Arabia and started something new. But we're actually not really sure that we know, right? Again, somewhat similar to what we have in historical Christianity or Jesus studies. Some of you may be aware that there was a period of time when in early Christianity the question was, did a person with the name of Jesus as described in the gospel actually ever exist? And there were some people that were, no, it's all made up. Such a person never existed, right? And so very similar things obtain within Islamic studies as well. So there is, on the one hand side, the traditional accounts. Muhammad, born from Amina and Abdullah in the year 570 of the Common Era, born in the city of Mecca, blah, 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 blah. That's a traditional narrative. But then you also have historical critical voices that raise a lot of questions on that. And we're going to look a little bit at some of those critical voices in the next couple of weeks. For the time being, for today, one exercise that we can do is how much do we, as a group, think we know, right? So what are some of the things that we know about Muhammad and the Quran? So to make it a little bit more interactive, throw it out there. What do we know? Already said a little bit of that. So let's collect on board. What do we know? Bethlehem, you had something. Catch and write something on the board for us. Bad toss, I know. I actually should bring in, let's see, one red one here. Yes, tell us what you know and put it on the board.
Oh, yeah, I'd say the Quran is like a compilation of revelations.
Okay, okay.
Like, not periodically, but in different
okay.
times. So
okay.
it's not like a dead fall from this.
Okay. Here it's also here. Yeah, this is also something that should work. Who else knows something? Yeah, I know. It's pathetic. Actually, you all share. I'm going to grab a couple of other pens, and I'll be back in a second, and then we can do this.
IE or EI? Received?
Oh, IE.
IE, okay.
Yeah, it doesn't follow the whole I before E, because that's received.
So I don't want to.
We think it's EI now.
I before E, except that was received.
Yeah.
No. I before E.
I'm
just asking. Central society. Exactly.
I'm what's the other
one?
Before
E.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before
E.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Society. I'm waiting to see what you're going to. I don't know. Terrible
science. English major? Anyone?
No. Nope. I guess so.
You're good at phonetics.
Why
don't you
send
the only 315?
Which
is probably dead.
Next time
we'll call this
with coffee.
Yeah, that isn't. These are probably green. I think they're dry. Canada, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Toronto's a burning like kind of microphone. I went there for a wedding and
it's like a slime service or even green juice.
It's really awkward.
How many verses were there?
Catholic wedding?
No, Jewish. Wow, really? Ouch.
Well, yeah, I don't know. You could have visited.
What's that called?
I mean, like,
so you're not
I'm not offended. I love you so much.
Good, Gabe, you're good.
No, I just know, like,
dream image,
Baptists
like, draw an image.
Don't drink, so everything they use is grape juice.
Like, what's that
kind of, like, Catholics don't. That's why I said,
oh,
yeah.
Just draw an
image.
I said, so I was like, whoa.
That was even, like, a
he's not going to stab you.
I don't know. I don't even know.
Hopefully not.
How do you say it?
Want to try this again, Hunter?
No, I know.
You got one.
I think they're a hard one.
I
think she'll definitely get
you. Lots of aggression there, the way I threw it at you, right?
Yeah, nice.
I
you are.
This one has
the word?
Yeah.
I'll try it. Okay.
You already signed a waiver
yeah,
form.
Oh,
I see.
Oh,
yeah.
Like, you throw on a Senate.
Well, I thought that waiver form was for the trip.
I'm just going to change it so it's for, you know. Titan can't be sued for throwing pens at you to your
fight. Was it Gabriel?
Yes,
exactly.
That's
like 30 minutes.
What is that word called, like, association of God with objects? Or?
Shirk. Yes,
Gabriel.
Oh my gosh, this is
real.
Oh,
so you're saying for the grand survey, 85%
Yes, exactly. You don't trust my math as much as Gabe does.
No, 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 I do. I'm just making sure.
I'm just kidding.
I love, yeah, that's the one that I was at. The part of the
I trust you, she's very generous.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not just adding 15, right? I'm doing the percentage.
Exactly.
Yes.
I just
want
to have you again.
Is it
A-U-R-I?
Which one are you?
Jahaliyah.
Twice. You have to
twice.
the other way around.
I know, but they're there. I just don't remember what
L-I-Y-Y.
Or just makes you doubt. And it smell.
So you saying
and we're saying
like, yeah, it's basically get the
I'm going to be a teacher and it's getting there.
At that point in time,
there's not like there are whiteboards in the classrooms, but teachers barely use them anymore.
But at that point in time, even, you know,
like when you write on the smart board, it'll spell check it. I'm sure. Right. Yeah. So that's coming.
I never really liked
it. I got away with faking it for the last 18 or 19 years. If I get away with it, definitely would be able to get away with it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you all are smart. So, no
better sharp and more dark.
And more aggressive.
Yeah. I don't know, where do you want these, by the way?
If you're done, like just put them somewhere else. On the
desk. It's so loud in there, you can't even talk.
Did you say kosher,
bro? I didn't know a word.
Hadash?
Not really much.
There you go.
That's one big haram.
Yes.
Why?
I was just wondering. Sure.
These things are working.
You hurt yourself?
Okay.
Whoa, okay, just because I misspelled receive. There's any good attention tie now.
Yeah, we got some stuff on here. So, folks that wrote, explain, what do we have? So the point of the exercise for today, this is a warm-up exercise to kind of get the field that we're studying into view. Of course, this won't ever be exhaustive. It's just a couple of points to kind of imagine the map that we're playing with. And once we have the map in view, we kind of have a sense of what we know or what we think we know, but also gaps, right? And that can help us a little bit in thinking about what we would like to do, right? So, very abstractly speaking, at the end of the day, last day of class, I envision that this mental map is going to be a whole lot more complete because we will have done more reading, but also because each of you will have contributed in some fashion to plugging in any perceived holes in the map that we have. You are following the logic here. Okay. So that having been said, let's have a quick look at what we do know, and then also start thinking about holds or desire to know more about something, where you can start thinking about and articulating what you yourself would like to work on to complete the picture. Who wants to start? Let's just go around the table. Mm-hmm. What did you put down?
I put down the Arabic version. It was only like a whole version, the rest were just considered to be translations.
Okay, yeah. Okay, we are all aware of that, right? The Quran is Quran only in its Arabic. In any other language, it's no longer God's word from a theological perspective. It's interpretation already. It doesn't carry divine power and beauty that only the Arabic inheres. Okay, very good. Theological claim there. Anything else you put down? And then the question. Where do we see holes? If you want to take any of that, or you just pass the ball to the next person.
Yeah. Wait, does that mean that we go to interpretations that we can't claim like a null and void understanding of it because it's not like having divine beauty and power?
Let's go at it right now. Repeat the question. Okay, and let's think about it all together.
So because of the theological claim that any language it's not, of course, Arabic of the Quran is an interpretation, and therefore it doesn't have the divine beauty and power that the Quran, the actual Quran, has. So does that mean that anything we go over, its interpretation in our language, doesn't quite count, and we can't actually use it in our argument?
Right.
Well, it doesn't quite count or cannot actually be used in an argument.
If we were arguing against someone who is using the Arabic,
right,
the real Quran,
right,
so to speak,
right,
could they be like, okay, you're talking from an interpretation
right,
standpoint or perspective, so everything you say,
right,
is not true?
Toss it out there. What do people think on that?
But then we can also say that, I mean, someone who speaks classical Arabic can misunderstand the Quran in like a major way. So, like,
yeah,
language is not... I mean, even reading itself, like the art of interpreting,
right,
that. I mean, you when you read it, you're already interpreting it.
Right.
So, like, the... is it called Ijtihad? Ijtihad.
Yes, Ijtihad.
Yeah. So...
struggling with the sources. Is that the word you're looking for?
Yes.
Okay.
So whether you're reading it in a different language or whether you're reading the actual Arabic,
mm-hmm,
you, when you read it, they're already, your character or what you went through or how you understand things really influences how you read it. So we can't really limit Arabic, we can't limit Islam to just Arabic and have all these people with different mindsets read it and understand it differently. So it's not just linguistics, and that's why I don't really believe in, I mean,
right,
you have to know Arabic to be a true Muslim.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Okay.
I agree with you.
Okay. You have to hold it.
Also, just playing off of something else, somebody put up there, I can't remember where it is, there is illiterate, Muhammad was illiterate,
yeah,
the idea that even he sort of didn't have like an interpretation on this, like he was just a blank slate for God's message, that was literally God's message,
right,
just with him being the speakerphone.
Right, right.
So
from a medieval perspective then, even Muhammad himself is not the author of the Quran, right, it's miraculously given to him, so that is in the, it is an interesting question of language in general, right? Whether language itself is a fixed entity that actually can give fixed meaning, right? Because what Bethlehem seems to be arguing is that even with, you know, a given sentence, with a given structure, even if that sentence is uncontested in its existence, the interpretation or understanding of that sentence can be contested. Right? So that ultimately speaking, there is no such thing. It's an interesting question whether there is such a thing as a literal understanding of a sentence that is uncontestable. And some would argue, I guess that's what I hear you say, there isn't such thing. Right? Even folks that claim to be literalists, ultimately speaking, are not really literalists. It's already in their own perception that there is a move of interpretation of understanding. Right? So yeah, those are very important, interesting questions. And related to that, of course, the question of privilege of languages.
Mm-hmm.
You see that in a lot of contexts, here in the United States in particular, the one country with the most diverse Muslim population in the world is right here, is in the United States of America. Because you have Muslims from so many different countries come together here. You don't have that diversity in any other context. That, of course, brings with it contestation, who is the best Muslim, who is the best privileged to understand, right? And so oftentimes in mosques you will find that there's tension between Arabic-speaking Muslims and Muslims from other parts of the world, and native Arabic-speaking Muslims oftentimes bring the argument, well, obviously we are more qualified because it's our native language. But that being contested by others who would say, no, it's more than just understanding the Quran. There are so many other factors that come into it. Right? So yeah, those are very interesting areas to explore. All right, you passed the ball, I think.
I had several.
Mm-hmm.
I had Havilio as his first wife.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm confused why someone pointed Jafir into that.
In all likelihood, because Khadija was, and this may have been a student who took the gender course, where Leila Ahmed is pointing out that Khadija is actually a wife that he married before Revelation, and she represents Jahiliya versus Aisha, who is marrying him after Revelation, so she represents Islam.
Yeah.
I see nodding. Yeah, is that
you had that's what I did. Because it was really interesting when talking about Muhammad's dealing with his wives, especially when talking about women in Islam, and how Jahiliya had its perks versus like Islamic women and wives had their perks. So that's why I pointed, because that was sort of who I was thinking of.
Okay.
Sorry, I didn't mean to take
it.
I mean, you took mine, so it's okay.
Okay. I had he received his first revelation at age 40.
Okay.
I had the four on the bottom.
Okay. Okay.
Is it 23 years, right?
Say what?
23 years.
Yes. Okay. And that is depending on how you do the counting. The 23 years is usually basing itself on the counting according to the Islamic calendar. So if you go with the solar calendar, it's 610 to 632, which would make for 22 years. But 22 solar years actually makes 23 lunar years, right? So 22, 23,
So he's only been in Mecca a year before fleeing?
Before Hijrah? No, 610 to 620... Is Hijra again 620 day? 22, yeah, 12 years.
Okay.
Right, 622 Hijra, and then 632 deaths. So 10 years in Medina. Yeah, right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. Now, of course, we're going to see this later on as far as his numbers are concerned. The number 40, for example, makes for a nice story. It's at age 40 that he comes into revelation. We know from other Semitic traditions that age 40 is oftentimes portrayed as the age of fullness, of wisdom. Other prophets who at age 40 had interesting experiences. Khadija's age 40 when she marries Muhammad, so the number repeats itself there. Many of us are somewhat doubtful that a 40-year-old woman would give birth to another 7 kids, right? That's a traditional account. So what's going on? So some scholars surmise, well, age 40 is a symbolic number. So are we to understand literally that he must have been 40 when he received revelation? It may be the case that this is an elaboration of later tradition round out the story somehow. So those are cues to look at the literature a little more critical to see is there any symbolism in this. The fact that later Muslim tradition records his birth date and his death date at the same on the same day is interesting. Birth dates up until modern times were usually not known. Oftentimes, you know, you wouldn't pay attention to a baby until it was at least 3 years old because it may not live, so why actually pay attention to the baby? Right? So, sorry, I'm over-dramatizing here, but, you know, the modern attitude that you actually know your exact birth date is a fairly modern phenomenon that probably wouldn't have applied, right? So you can start asking critical, incisive questions, right? Okay, want to say some more on what you put down or on where you want to go, where you may want to contribute, or want to pass the ball?
I'm interested in learning about like the order in which it was revealed.
Okay.
Okay.
So you're over here somewhere, so one of the questions is revelation / order of surahs. Say a little bit more about that. If you want.
Well, it's. I know, like, even whole surahs were not revealed at the same time, so I was.
Right.
I'm confused about how it
right.
came to be,
right.
the way it
right.
is now.
Open it up to the class for a second. How much do we know at this point in time about revelation and order of surahs, when stuff was revealed? What do we know?
It's sort of the abrogation thing again. From
okay.
earlier, it was an example.
Okay. So there's abrogation. Say a little bit about that.
Statement B, Trump's statement A, in a sense.
Abrogation. Anybody in this room who has not heard of abrogation before?
Just
There are verses in the Quran that appear to, well, actually, why don't you, why should I talk? Talk a bit about that creation.
The only one I know that's like really prominent is about the one on wine, which is like, wine is good, wine's not so good, wine's pretty bad, wine's forbidden. And
so various verses in the Quran, at various points in the Quran, the Quran talks about khamr, about intoxicants, about wine, right? And so there are some verses, sorry to interrupt.
Go for it.
Tossing the ball to me. Some verses talk about the wine is positive, others ambivalent, and some very critical. Most critical one, it's the devil's handiwork, don't touch it, right? Another one has it that you shouldn't approach prayer when drunk because you may not know what you're saying, so you may inadvertently say pray for something that you really don't want, right? So then the question is, how come that the Quran has contradictory statements? The answer is abrogation, and that is to say, the Muslim scholarship in medieval times makes the argument, at various points in time, God didn't change his mind, or her mind, but rather God is gradually, with subsequent revelations, getting a people ready to embrace new behavior. So God knew that the Arabs were hopeless drunkards, so he couldn't take them off cold turkey. So what he did is he's problematizing it in earlier verses, by telling them, well, you may want to be a little bit careful. And then a couple of years later, once they're ready, he is yanking it, right? So he's totally forbidding it. That's the notion of abrogation, that these later verses modify or, in a sense, interpret earlier verses. Okay, so that is one initial medieval answer to parts of the question of revelation and revelatory sequence. Muslim tradition overall differentiates between verses revealed in Mecca and Medina. So the early verses, many of you know this, when you look later in the Quran, the shorter surahs are actually earlier, were revealed in Mecca, very succinct, often rhyming, short verses that have a very rhythmic appearance to them. Later verses, much more elaborate, oftentimes much longer sentence structures. We're going to look at all of this in more detail later on. Again, as a point of comparison for those of you who've done a little bit of biblical studies, how many of you are aware when it comes to Hebrew scripture? Let's do a kind of comparison thing down here. When it comes to Hebrew scripture, Torah, that there are similar arguments being made. So, for example, that the deity that the Israelites worshipped at different points in the scripture is called either Elohim, or is called Yahweh, or is called something else. Most of you have come across that, right? And so what modern scholarship has done, Wellhausen onwards to the 19th century, is taken the way that God is referred to as either Yahweh or Yahweh Elohim actually as a combination, to determine that some of these textual fragments are more ancient than others, that they may be of different vintages. For example, how many of us are aware that the Genesis account of the creation of the world is actually a dual account, that there's more than one creation story? Anybody seen that? When you look at the Bible, Genesis 1:1, you start out with a very orderly account, 7 days, right? When you go to Genesis chapter 2, verse 4b, all of a sudden the narrative starts over again. God is creating again, right? So there's different accounts in there, and then you can tell by various indications, including the name of God, that these were penned at different points in time by different groups of authors or by different folk traditions. You all following? So that's what we have in Hebrew scriptures, and translate that over to the Quran. It's not quite as pronounced, but there is a couple of instances where God is referred to by different names. So early on, for example, you have Rabb, the Lord, thy Lord, Rabbuka, where God is addressed as your Lord. And later on, you have Allah, of course. That is kind of the standard phrase, right? and then Rahman, there's a couple of other names. So those seem to be indications of different time periods, vintages, influences.
Also that on the, not tense, but the person, the point of view changes. Sometimes
yes,
it's
exactly.
You, sometimes it's we.
Exactly. So singular, plural is in there. Other perspectives are in there. So all of these indications that there is something interesting at work. Need not necessarily mean that these are totally different texts, different authors, but it does indicate that the circumstances under which the text arises seem to be slightly different. Right? And there's very interesting theories on that. Some of them we're going to study later on. But, you know, to sensitize ourselves when reading the text to small things like that, that ordinarily we wouldn't pay attention to. This is why it's going to be important when we read this text to really read with a lot of attention, to not just want to get through 100 pages quickly, but where it really is pay attention, be the detective, to see what can I find here, what looks. And sometimes it actually takes 10 or more readings to actually for something to jump out at you. So we're going to do a little bit of that, read something over and over again, compare it with other stuff we read. If the first time nothing jumps out, you read it another time, you read it 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times, and then eventually something will jump out at you. And those moments are fun. Not of them, but when it jumps, it's fun. Okay, so yeah. So that's a very interesting question. Because most of you know this again, let me just let's talk a little bit about that. I'm too lazy to actually get up. Let's just down here. How many surahs to the Quran?
114.
114.
Oh, there it is. Okay. Anybody have understanding, and some of you do, the organizing principle that we have currently in printed copies of the Quran? Longest to shortest, with the exception of Fatiha. The first one is a 7-liner, right? And after that, Baqarah, second one is really long, last one on 14, very short, right? So organized in length. So when you look at the Quran and read it from cover to cover, it's messy, it doesn't seem to be making a lot of sense. It's not like biblical literature. Bible, overall speaking, you start page one, you start creation, and you read all the way in narrative linear line toward the end of history, right? If you read Bo's Torah, Tanakh all the way with New Testament to the end, you know, Apocalypse, that's where it stops, end of the word, right? So it's really this long line. Quran doesn't do you that favor. It's all over the place, right? So the organizing principle is not narrative linearity, but organizing principle is simply from long to short, right? So then you have to look for other organizing principles, and one of them would be revelatory sequence. This German scholar, you're going to hear this name a lot, Angelika Neuwirth. We will read her, we will read one article of hers, and I can almost make this promise to you. Out of all of the articles that you've ever read at Furman, this may be the most tricky one you will read. It may be a good preparation for grad school, right? I can't universally make that promise. There's probably a couple of disciplines that have more messy stuff to offer, but Angelika Neuwirth is up there. It's very messy, but very rewarding materials. Once you've understood her, all of a sudden, ooh, the word makes sense again. So, Grace, help with
that. The question about the order of the surahs, I just assumed that the community came to Muhammad with questions and sort of what should we do when this happens or when that happens,
right?
Including like women's issues, like
right.
And so I thought that the revelations were not like periodic or anything, but rather like addressing society's concern, like layer by layer type thing.
Yes and no. So from a traditional narrative perspective onward, and that goes in the question of the order of surahs, there is a huge body of literature, and it's called Asbab al-Nuzul. I'm going to give you a fair amount of vocab here. We're going to come back to much of that. Asbab al-Nuzul, the occasions of revelation. So the traditional narratives tell us that, let's do more broadly, I'm going to give you a footnote to a footnote now. The historical critical questions that I've been alluding to focus on the fact and on the understanding that whereas the Quran itself, as we have it, is understood by the vast majority of scholars as an ancient 7th century document. So most scholars look at the Quran and they say, oh yes, this looks like a document that could very well have arisen in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century. When it comes to material explaining the life of Muhammad, we don't have that luxury. So what we have over here is mostly 8th, well actually 8th is optimistic, 9th and later century material. So this is much later material. This material, however, if you only had this material, you only had the Quran, you would be at a loss. Most of us have seen verses of the Quran. They do seem to make some sense to us. It's not a really comprehensive picture. It's not like the Bible, the narrative that is nicely sequenced, that gives you coherent long stories, but rather it gives you snippets here and there. So on the question of gender, it gives you a verse here, it gives you a little bit there, gives you marriage laws, etc. But no comprehensive system, right? So if you only had that, you'd be at a loss to construct systems of meaning out of that. Lo and behold, that's where this stuff comes in. This is very little, right? Very short book. This is humongous. Tons and tons and tons and tons of materials. Zira, Marazi, Hadith, literature. Hundreds of volumes. Exegetic material, add another couple of hundred volumes to that. Humongous, but late, right? So this material helped in traditional Islam to make sense of this material, but it is very late. And that, of course, raises suspicions of historians. How come that, you know, this material is 200 years after that material, and is ironing out all of the problems of this material. So when you look at it in that perspective, you're right. This has lots of material on the question of gender, yes. So there's a verse about women, something that they inherit, or this is one verse about the woman who argued, right? If you just look at these couple of verses about the woman who argued, that by itself wouldn't make a lot of sense to you. Could mean lots of things. That's where this later material comes in and tells you exactly what the situation was when the verse comes down. Which is beautiful if it's reliable. All of a sudden you have all of this detail. But if it's unreliable, and that's what pessimists, some of the pessimists would say, well, it's actually made up to explain this text that otherwise doesn't make any sense. So that's kind of the conundrum that we find ourselves in. And it's going to be messy and it's going to be fun.
Okay, so if it's not chronological, then how does the abrogation work?
Do you have...
Like, what if one thing actually came after, but it's written before?
Right. We don't know. Right. So what we have is we have these contradictory materials, and we have texts. Again, I'm oversimplifying. It's not quite as messy as that. 200 years later, the text, or 150 years later, these explanatory texts are telling us, well, that's what happened. Is that believable? Is it plausible? Some would say yes, some would say no, or something in between. Right? So abrogation is a perfect example, right, of the what the pessimists would see as the messiness of the Quran that only can be rescued by these later stories and can be made sensible and reasonable by this later story. So abrogation as one of those stories to make sense of what otherwise would be a nonsensical text. Again, I'm over-dramatizing here, but that's kind of the relation between the two. Right? Okay, Sante.
I don't know if anybody has done anything like to tell people how they should read the Quran, because if you can't read it from the beginning to the end.
He'll tell you. Yeah. No, there's one book that actually I've used on occasion in the Intro to Islam, and it's Michael Sells' Approaching the Quran. That was a book that was adapted by the University of North Carolina University System after 9/11 as the reading assignment for freshmen. We don't have that at Furman anymore. We used to have the common book that every incoming freshman would read. And so they adopted it the year after 9/11 as their book, and it was a huge uproar. somebody likened it to, German universities adopting Mein Kampf after the Holocaust, right? But, yeah. So it was very controversial, but that's an easy, schmeasy way. It focuses on the later verses of the Quran, which are the earliest verses according to Muslim tradition revealed, verses that talk about heaven, hell, the fire, what have you, etc. And so, you know, apart from this one, I would say Michael Sells.
Can I ask an off-topic question?
I suppose you can.
So, in English, in Islam, God is without gender, so in English you use he because we don't have a gender neutral pronoun.
Right.
Is that also the case in Arabic?
Yes.
Or
yes.
They use he?
Yep. Allah, yes. Allah. Ooh.
Is that the case in other languages?
Yes. And that is due to, I'm not aware of any that top of my head, I'm not aware of any that don't do it. Goethe Lerner would say that's the universality of patriarchy, right? Patriarchal structures wherever you go. So, yeah. Okay. So, map, and so we see a couple of areas where we are curious. So others, you want to pass the ball? You want to continue?
I'll pass. So I put the Nas history depicted because we watched The Message.
The Message.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Last history, and that was one of the things that I thought was really interesting. Which the fact that a 3-hour movie holds your attention is impressive.
Yeah.
But no, I just think it's a really interesting element. And then we sort of talked about it when we had the 3D PowerPoint about the sacred spaces of Islam throughout the world, and the ways that the history of the religion intersect with the ways that worship happens, and then how that how that matters or why that matters because of Muhammad and the Quran. So that's sort of why, and just something I think is interesting, because I think it's interesting the ways that in Christianity Jesus is depicted, and I think it's sort of interesting in thinking in terms of, just kind of
right. That aspect of when you compare Christianity to Islam and or to Judaism, the question of incarnation, right? A religious tradition that actually envisions God as body. Right, versus the other Abrahamic traditions that actually consider that an absolute no-no, that's a no-go for them, right? So I think they are very interesting, if you're comparatively inclined, they are very interesting questions you can ask. Mm-hmm. And they are, to a certain extent, I think, Christian theological questions. What does it mean that a religious tradition claims God did indeed become man? Or human, gender question, in the question of sexuality, and Muslim responses to that, right? So when you see Surah 112, right, he begetteth not, nor is he begotten, right? So what, or some of the verses that, that seem to suggest that Christians do believe in a Trinity that includes Mary, questions of the sexuality of God. I mean, there's fun stuff to explore in that comparative mode, right? So, yeah, fascinating stuff. And then, you know, on what we know, and then also, since we're going there at the same time, what we don't know, so that there are areas to explore. Mm-hmm. Great. I just want to pass the ball.
So I wrote Jahadiyah and Islamic wives, and mm-hmm. Muhammad had one wife, that was Jahadiyah, and Muhammad had multiple Islamic wives. And so just, it's really interesting when you talk about women, gender, mm-hmm. and women, especially in Islam, and it's depicted as, Islam is depicted as a barrier for women's rights, I guess would be a good way of saying it, or like a hurdle for women mm-hmm. and individual rights. But if you look at it more closely, it's not what it seems. It's not as it's depicted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's plus sides to being an Islamic woman, and there's plus sides to being Jahadiyah, mm-hmm. and the times and how those are related, especially, like, for instance, Jahadiyah, it would be horrible for you to have a daughter. Like, that was a huge thing. Mm-hmm. And, like, if you didn't have a son, that was a huge thing. Even in Arabic culture, still now today, in some cultures, that's kind of like, you always want a son. Mm-hmm. But in Islamic texture, Islamic text, what we read, there was a slight change. Mm-hmm. I mean, before like medieval Islam came and started like becoming as big as it was, mm-hmm. Women enjoyed a lot of rights. So that was really interesting. But once it became established as a major religion and started growing, like all religions, things changed. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are now. I wrote 6:28.
Okay.
He did. That's the day he died. That's the year.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Yep. Yep.
You know, that's just that he did. So you're at Hudaybiyah, you're at one of the major treaties before the conquest of Mecca.
Honestly, yeah.
Close. Of course, everybody in this class, but you knew that, right? Probably nobody in this class really knew that.
It was a really cool. Yeah. And then I wrote Mountain Man in quotes.
Okay.
The same, like, he had his revelation in the mountains.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
So you're not thinking Duck Dynasty or anything?
No, not at all. I know it's just like an easy way of just reading it. And then I wrote Year of the Elephant as well. So,
okay. Cool. So those are some of the, and, you know, as we said earlier, with some of the dates, of course, you know, the mountain symbolism, right? Why does Muslim tradition depict Muhammad going up the mountain? To receive revelation, who has done that before?
Moses,
right? Think the Gospel of Matthew,
Jesus.
Where Jesus is depicted as a second Moses, so that kind of you know, symbolism is in there. The year of the elephant, of course, that's the year that he's supposed to be born, and that's the year that the Abyssinian ruler is attacking Mecca with the yeah. But at that point in time, not quite friends yet, right?
Yeah.
So the Abyssinian ruler is coming with an elephant to attack Mecca and destroy the Kaaba, and God won't allow for that. Quran, again, there's a verse in the Quran that talks about birds defending the Kaaba, and that's being turned into this story, historians would say, you know, the bird being defeated by the birds.
Why wouldn't he have let the Kaaba be destroyed since it was a shrine to
good question.
All these other
good
gods?
Good question.
Do you really like
so what we have in the Quran, actually, we had somebody who has the Quran over, we could look at the verses, right? So there's a couple of verses that allude in some very broad, general fashion to the birds that are defending the Kaaba. Nobody knows. And if we only had this, we could make up a zillion different stories. That's where tradition jumps in. Critical story and say, you know, centuries later, fills these gaps with gorgeous, beautiful stories about God sending birds with small pebbles in their beaks who drop the pebbles on the elephant and the army. First use of air force in the world, right? to defeat the army, right? So, again, kind of tension between Quran, early text, and later text that kind of explain what's going on. So, and then again, in terms of possibilities, so there's lots of gaps in here where we can work with what's of interest.
Why would Muhammad send the followers to? Abyssinia.
If
they do not have good rapport. So it's. I'm guessing it's after.
Exactly.
After.
It's later on the year of, and that's actually the other one, 628, 629, is the year of deputations, mm-hmm. when Muhammad now sends letters. The opening scene of the message film has this, right? He's sending letters, messengers with letters, to the rulers of the world. At that point in time, Abyssinia, right, Najash is ruling Abyssinia, Ethiopia. You have Kisra of Egypt. You have Khosrow, ruler of Persia, and you have Heraclius, ruler of Byzantium, and then a couple of others. And they each get a letter, Muhammad inviting them to convert to Islam. And then it's very interesting, again, these letter stories, how these folks react. Actually, some of the stories fascinating. I'm working on some of them right now. The ruler of Abyssinia is actually said to have converted already at that point in time. He's already a Muslim. Except that he can't let any of his followers know because they would kill him if they found out that he wasn't a Christian any longer. Same with Heraclius. So there are stories that Heraclius also is converting to Islam, but then he learns that another bishop of his who had converted to Islam was stoned by priests. So he doesn't admit publicly that he converted to Islam. Right? So again, ask yourself the question, why would these texts want to claim those, right? Interesting, fascinating stuff. I mean, that's stuff where you can play, right? So for those of you who are interested in the life of Muhammad, fascinating stories about all of these folks that converted to Islam. Why would somebody want to do that? Heraclius in particular, he is the guy, I just was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You would think it's nothing to do with what I'm talking about here, right? Life is crazy. Santa Fe, New Mexico has a cathedral, one of the oldest cathedrals in the United States, right? The Spaniards coming in. In the cathedral, you have relics. And among the relics, you have a piece of the True Cross. Does anybody know what the True Cross is all about?
No.
Nobody ever heard of the True Cross?
The actual cross which Jesus hung from?
The actual cross from whence Jesus hung. Anybody else have
anything? Monasteries in Ethiopia also say that they have pieces.
Yeah. Pieces all over the world. Story is, in the 4th century, the wife, I think, of Constantine the Great. Constantine the Great, everybody recognizes, right? Wife of Constantine the Great actually discovers the true cross on which Jesus hung in Jerusalem. That point in time, Constantine had just moved the capital of the empire from Rome, Italy, to
Istanbul,
Constantinople, the palace of Constantine, right, in what is now Turkey. Helena is a mother of Constantine, grabs the cross from Jerusalem, brings it to Constantinople, the new empire. It resides there for a long time, up until 1204 of the Common Era. 1204 Common Era, what happens? Anybody?
Crusades.
Crusades, not the fall yet. Crusades. Fourth Crusade. Crusades, everybody familiar with, right? Beaten up them infidels. Fourth
Crusade. They sack Constantinople.
Sack of Constantinople, exactly. So Western Christians are moving into Constantinople, into the Eastern Empire, and grab everything of value out of Hagia Sophia, out of the sacred church. Lots of gold, silver, whatever you could carry, and the cross. From there, the cross, in pieces, they already have been distributed earlier, but in pieces now moves to Western Christian churches. So you go to France, you go to churches in Germany, Italy, actually Rome. Everywhere you go, you will find small pieces of the true cross. Pascal actually said, if you put all of these pieces of the true cross together, you end up with a humongous cross, so according to which Jesus must have been something like 20 feet high, I don't know what, right? So there's a whole lot of these pieces of true cross. But some of them actually end up in the New World, right? So this is 1492, Columbus sails the ocean blue, what have you, and some of this stuff now moves over the side of the Atlantic. So in Santa Fe this summer I saw a piece of true cross in Santa Fe, of all places. So back to, long story, our time here, Heraclius is actually the guy who in the 7th century had saved the true cross. It had been captured by the Persians a couple of years prior, and he actually recaptures it, right? So that's where Heraclius comes in. So Heraclius actually touched the true piece of the cross that I saw in Santa Fe. That was a very long-winded explanation of Santa Fe, Heraclius and Muhammad.
I guess going to the question that I think would be a interesting topic, I really like all the politics sides and the political side of all this, and I really want to see how the Quran and Muhammad are, how the change of their depiction has affected the rise of radicalism or certain degrees of radicalism in Islam,
okay.
And how that also the depiction of these two things, a person and a thing, can change to maybe better suit Islam in a modern time.
Yes. And you can trace it you can trace it from early 9th century texts all the way through 21st century. Two books that came out recently, Ahmed Safi, one of them, Memories of Muhammad, and Keisha Ali just came out with a book last year. So Keisha Ali, she's at Boston U. Safi was here a couple of years ago. He's at UNC Chapel Hill, Memories of Muhammad. And Keisha Ali's newest book, Lives of Muhammad.
You said Safi teaches at Chapel Hill?
Exactly.
I think my sister took a class with
him. Okay, he's a marvelous guy. Yeah. He's the best. I mean, he's really... But Keisha embedded herself. she's also a marvelous scholar. She's at Boston U. But those two would be right down that alley. Yes?
Are Sunni and Shia accounts of Muhammad's life similar or different?
Similar. Shia accounts, I'm not off the top of my head aware of any early ones. I think there are some later. And actually, Ahmed Safi probably has something more on that. But the earliest ones that we have, well, actually, they're more complicated than that, because the earliest ones that we have, nobody is quite sure, everybody is suspecting those folks of possibly being Shia. So Ibn Ishaq al-Waqidi in particular have been branded by some of the Sunnis as possible crypto-Shia. Okay, so more. Yes?
I just had a comment on the whole, like, how the interpretation has changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
With what Samuel was saying, I think, well, I know a lot of that has to do with the interpretation of the word jihad and how that word has gone through different phases, I guess, of interpretation. And that's because of different leaders and external factors,
mm-hmm.
but essentially gone between the internal struggle to be a Muslim and the struggle against people that are not Muslim.
Right. So there's another possible project, right, that you can look at, and that is the interpretation of jihad in various time periods.
Yes.
Now, one needs to be a little bit careful because there is this apologetic discourse that, you know, it's nothing but, the internal stuff, the other stuff doesn't really exist at all. That's kind of somewhat one-sided apologetic discourse, as is the other side that is always only about that.
Mm-hmm.
There are interesting hypotheses, actually, that the militarization of the term jihad has a whole lot to do with Christian notions of crusade, that before crusade, jihad actually wasn't what it was.
Yeah.
So there's, you can trace very interesting historical developments. The best, easy access to that one is Firestone's Book of Jihad. So Ruben Firestone Jihad. Did you have one on that? No.
No. I've got, not to take us back or anything, but sort of when did like the mentality of like Dar al-Islam have?
Yes.
And did that come into play when we started saying these are Muslim lands? And or it, maybe is it as old as the Hijra, maybe when Muhammad fled and told them there's a king who would accept you or whatever, or he invited other kings to accept Islam? Like how, when did, what cemented like this like line?
So Dar al-Islam versus Dar al-Harb, right? The abode of Islam versus the abode of war is a medieval concept that makes jihad, as in lesser jihad of safe, the jihad of the sword possible. And it's a medieval fiqh injunction, so we're talking 9th, 10th century in that dichotomized fashion. I'm not aware of the first trace of the word, but as a system, right, that talks about jihad as safe, armed warfare against the enemy. I know that it's, you know, the classical fiqh manuals, the classical law manuals of the, not even 9th, 10th, 11th century, so I would say, where that's prominent.
So we can't draw from, like, I know like the word may not have appeared earlier in Islam.
Right.
But, like, waging war, you know, even against Mecca.
Right.
You know, like as like disbelievers or prosecutors of believers or whatever, couldn't we draw from that? I mean, like we can't exactly define it. But.
My German favorite word is "Jein," which is a combination of yes and no.
Okay.
It's complicated by the fact we have the Quran again, as I said, early text, 150-200 years later we have this stuff. So what we have in the Quran is we have jihada and jihad, so the root. JHD a number of times in the Quran. Firestone will tell you exactly how often. Oftentimes, jihada fi sabil Allah, in the way of God. But oftentimes, not jihada, but qatilu, this root, QTL, killing. Again, fi sabil Allah, in the way of God. So we have those in the Quran. But we have them, again, in non-contextualized form with lots of interpretational possibilities. What they mean to the audience, we only learn in this later form, right? So now we're 200 years later, and that's where the tafsir is. So in how far the tafsir actually reflects 7th century realities, we don't know. When you read Donner, when we start reading Fred Donner, we are going to see that the way that our later texts have it, this differentiation between Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb, probably didn't apply to Muhammad's own time. It was a bit more complicated than that. But an interesting research project. So the point of what we're doing here right now, and I think by now it becomes clear, right? So we have things we know, and we think we know, but then once we start talking about it, all of a sudden we see, oh, here's something interesting that we don't know, right? And where there's possibilities to explore. So. Yeah. Okay. Others. Where's the ball right now? Who's passing the ball to me?
Yeah, what was that?
Okay.
No, I wrote the first one, Collection of Different Revelations, and found not that long, but
Right. And we saw already, and it's related to the question of the watering of the surahs, right? So when, and the compilation itself is very interesting. If we get to the video that I was hoping to show, we'll see a little bit of that stuff as well. Mm-hmm. So, okay. I said I was unionized, and I said we deserve a break. How about taking a 10-minute break or something like that, reconvening 20 past? And seeing whether we're going to continue the line a little bit longer or whether people want to tackle the video. You can think over the break what you're
So you're back 20 past.
Whoa.